that was one of the most defining moments in my life, was receiving that diagnosis, but then how I responded to the diagnosis. Eventually I was like, okay, I have to accept this. That, I think, naturally cultivated an introspective journey that I've been on ever since.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 96 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, I have the brilliant Hannah Moore, the founder of LA Pacific. I don't give out the brilliant compliment very often, so you know it's going to be a good interview. First, I want to remind you to subscribe to the newsletter every Monday. Every Monday, I put out the Idea Lab newsletter. And I also put out the Idea Lab podcast, and it's on YouTube as well. So if you're not subscribed to the newsletter, go to MrGaryFox.com and you will be able to subscribe right there. And it's filled with all the ideas I talk about on a Monday. And I also share all the links and all the good stuff that I don't get to talk about on the podcast. So go and subscribe to that right now. Let's get straight into today's episode with Hannah Moore. Hannah is the founder of LA Pacific, and it is a whirlwind story. Hannah only started this company in 2019. She'd been preparing it for a little while before that, but the growth in the last 18 months has been explosive. She's now stocked in Boots, both here and in the UK. She's also on Amazon, and she also sells directly on her own website as well. So I'm going to go straight into this. There's not going to be a big introduction today. Welcome to my chat with Hannah Moore, the founder of LA Pacific. Hannah, welcome to the pod.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Give me the quick intro to yourself that I ask everybody.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Hannah Moore. We are the world's first teeth whitening enzymatic toothpaste range, and we're clinically proven to get you whiter teeth in 60 seconds.
That's a nice, snappy intro. You've done a lot of pitches recently, I can tell.
Yeah, I'm definitely in the flow of pitches, which is exciting, really, really exciting in terms of the growth of the business. So it's really nice, actually refreshing to be here to talk about the wider story as well.
Good. Yeah. A mutual friend of ours, Patrick, introed me to you. I followed your story a little bit, but give people a quick background as to, actually, just a quick background on yourself, actually, because it's quite interesting.
Yeah, sure. So I actually grew up in the Middle East until I was 12. And then I moved back home and I went to school in Athlone. I then went on to study psychology up in Galway. And I then went on to do a master's in organizational and social psychology in London. And I feel like I've had a number of different experiences that have maybe prepared me for this, but not necessarily that you could have looked at and say predicted where I might be today. So some of those, well, first off, my mom, my absolute hero. So she's a single mom, but she's also an entrepreneur. So she actually has her own Montessori school. So she looked at the Montessori sector within the Middle East and decided that actually none of these schools were good enough for my older brother, Barry. And she decided to set up her own school, which she then used to school all of us. So I had that kind of entrepreneur. And so once I left university, so once I finished my master's, I went on to become a lettings agent. And then after that, I went on to do recruitment. So I was a recruitment consultant, which I guess they're both commission-based sales roles. So, you know, if you don't sell, you don't earn. But what I really took from those experiences was learning how to show people a vision, whether it be for a flat or whether it be for a job, and also learning how to ask questions, but more importantly, learning how to actually listen to people and then respond to that as well. So, you know, then you can start to understand people's behavior. You can start to understand, okay, well, what motivates someone to buy a house? What motivates someone to take a job? But ultimately, I left recruitment consulting. I wanted something that was a little bit more creative, something that was a little bit more diverse in terms of where I could kind of expand my world of knowledge in terms of business. So in 2015, I joined Deloitte's management consulting program, their graduate program, which was like going back to university, but getting paid. We actually had 6 weeks of training, which was it was amazing, you know, to learn from all these different experts and go into consulting. And that was the last job I had before I became the mother of LA Pacific.
We've had very random backgrounds as well. I have a very, very similar background to yourself. Lots of random things that don't really tie together. But now that I'm a little bit older, I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe that, or maybe I'm just been, maybe I'm just kind of retrofitting it, going, oh, it all ties together now. Yeah, I've been a letting agent as well. I've done a lot of that stuff. Where in the Middle East did you grow up?
I grew up in Dubai. So that was an amazing place to grow up, you know, to see the growth, the extreme growth that happened over such a short period of time. But you know, I was actually really happy to come back to Ireland and, you know, come back to my roots. And, you know, all my aunties and uncles are here, my cousins, my grandparents, and you can't beat the Irish culture. Like, you can't beat the Irish people. And yeah, but I feel like I had the best of both worlds. You know, I got to bring this big city vision of growth and then tie that to, you know, my cultural roots and the hearts and kindness and openness and wit of, yeah, being Irish. So yeah, I feel like I got the best of both.
Dubai to Athlone though, that's a jump. That is a jump.
That was a huge jump. Yeah, I went from interactive whiteboards to blackboards.
Acetates and overhead projectors and rolling in the VHS. Well, you're probably not that old, actually. Rolling in the VHS player. That's a massive leap. Was that tough?
It was tough. I was definitely nervous. It took me a while to kind of adapt, but I think that's one of my strengths is adapting, is, you know, from quite a young age, just understanding, I guess with that, I definitely, when I look back, could see how much I wanted to fit in. Part of that was actually, so you can see that I've got really, really curly hair. I would spend an hour every day straightening my hair because I wanted to fit in. So that was kind of the real start of that. But yeah, it was tough. But I'm really glad that I did it. Again, maybe retrospectively trying to make it all fit experience. I'm still connected to some of the girls from that school. And yeah.
And what was it? Did you always, obviously your mum is a massive driving force here in terms of she was an entrepreneur, and that's often a very, very common. I actually must go back and look at the interviews and see how many entrepreneurs have had an entrepreneurial experience in the family. Generally, I would say it's high 90%, if not more, because generally there's an influence, whether it's a cousin or a brother or a mother or a dad, mm-hmm. or whoever, just to show someone the way, because I think that's very, very important. So like, and your mum solved her own problems, which I find very interesting. She solved that there was no place suitable for her, for you guys. So yeah, that's talk to me a little bit about that, growing up in an entrepreneurial household.
I think what I learned most from my mum was resilience. So whatever came her way, and many things have come her way, you know, setting up a business as a woman in the Middle East, you know, comes with, you know, a plethora of problems or obstacles. But I guess the way that she saw them were as challenges to learn and grow from. So I think that is where I learned that, you know, no matter what comes through your path, you are greater than it. So your capacity, yourself, is greater than whatever comes your way. And I think having that ability to believe in yourself, and it's still something that I have to nurture, it's like a muscle. That self-belief means that, you know, you never feel trapped. You're never kind of closed in on, what am I going to do? I'm totally overwhelmed. And sometimes you do have those moments, but then it's about circling back to, I've got this. Actually, everything eventually works out. It might not work out how you envisioned it, but I think that speaks to the infinite potential of a vision, right? You know, if you finite it, if you're like, this is how it has to look, this is when it has to happen, you're actually limiting your potential. So yeah, I think combining that, you know, resilience with unconditional self-belief.
That's a big statement. Talk to me a little bit about that, because I was just thinking about that this week, is that you never reach a point as an entrepreneur, because I was having it myself. I was having one of those moments where it's like, Jesus Christ, what am I doing? How do you do that? How do you tap back in? How do you bring yourself back to the place of going, no, Hannah, do you know what? It's going to be fine. Do you have a process, or is it visualization, or do you just go back to a time where it worked, or how do you do that?
So I think two things that have really stood to me. So one of them is quite a recent thing that I have done, which is looking at, I guess, you have these moments of, or epiphanies where you're like, ah, and one of those moments that I had was I was really conscious of the information that I was putting into my brain. So we're the products of our environments. I truly believe that. And an interesting piece, if people want to look into that even more, is Dr. Bruce Lipton, The Biology of Belief, and just going back to our origin. So going back to a cell origin and understanding how your environment, so what feeds you, will shape what you look like. So with that, one of the things that I noticed was I had a cognitive distortion of thoughts that can sometimes come up in our minds. You know, it's part of the human beauty, but also the human, it can be a detriment to ourselves, which is, you know, those beliefs that aren't actually true, but that can create this cyclical kind of catastrophizing, self-deprecating view of yourself. So I have a daily practice now that I've introduced whereby I look at those, I just brain dump. So, you know, whatever fear is arising, whatever those kind of self-deprecating things might be, and I recognize them as being a cognitive distortion. So a distortion of what's actually true. And then underneath that, so I just scribble a line and then I write what's actually true. So what's actually true is that, you know, I'm inherently valuable. I'm unconditionally valuable. Well, my value is not tied to solving a problem. It's tied to me being alive. And that's just, it's the most grounding thing ever. And again, it's sometimes there are some days that I don't do it and I definitely notice when I don't do it. But that's one of the things. And then the other thing is therapy as well. So I've actually been in constant therapy for the last 5 years and I don't think it's spoken about enough. And it's something I'm actually really proud of. To say, actually, once a week or, you know, once every 2 weeks, I dedicate an hour to talking about me.
Absolutely. And I'm really happy you shared that because I think, well, two things there you shared that are very important. The daily practice. I like people who talk about honest things that they do because often it's very kind of wishy-washy. Oh, be good to yourself. And it's not really anything that doesn't tell people how to help themselves. So thanks for sharing that. I do very similar. I'm not as advanced as you. I'm not as deep as you. Mine is just a brain dump. It's just like I found I couldn't switch my brain off at night. It was just like running. So I do a brain dump as well at the evenings. I just brain dump what's been going on. Oh, you know, I always have this fear of forgetting stuff. I'm like, geez, it's not that important. So I just write it down and go, oh, just do this tomorrow. Just and just helps just to, I think of it like a computer. I think of like, just like shutting down, just like, you know, clearing the desktop and just like shutting it down. And then the morning I just open up the notebook again and just scribble out what I'm going to do. And often the stuff you've written down before is like ridiculous stuff. And you're like, why was I even worried about that? So yeah, thank you for that. And the therapy piece, because again, yeah, absolutely not spoken about very much. I think there's a lot of topics, in Ireland, especially, we don't talk about. So yeah, thank you for sharing both of those. Actually, talk to me about being a letting agent actually first, because I had a lot of interesting experiences. Where were you doing it and what got you into it?
So I was doing it in London. I had found an apartment in Camden and I was actually going in to pay my deposit. So I was in this queue in the lettings agent to go up to the account department, and I ended up, who had just walked by, and we got chatting of the lettings agency, and I told him I just finished my master's, and he was like, why don't you work here? So I said, great, will you offer me a 10% discount on my rent? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, okay, we have a deal.
No way.
So that's how I got into it. Yeah.
That's great. That's probably the best story of the pod so far. I love it. Right. Okay. That's and what was that like, London? I'd imagine that's a tough business to be in London.
Yeah, for sure. Luckily, the lettings agency that I joined had a really big portfolio. And I joined a team who were really willing to share, not necessarily expertise. It was very much, I was kind of like learning on the job. So learning how to juggle, you know, different interests. I found a way to categorize, people who had just expressed interest on sparrows and maybe develop that into something a little bit more concrete for myself, versus, you know, people that I had to say, okay, they're right off. They're not actually going to be interested in taking this room, so it's not worth my time. But yeah, it gave me a great platform to use my voice, learn how to sell a product. And also I got to, you know, I was walking most of the time. So I actually got to know the ins and outs of North London, like the back of my hand, which was another amazing, amazing thing.
And how long did you do that for?
Didn't do it for that long. I think it was about 5 months before, again, I kind of got itchy feet. I wanted to do something new. I wanted to expand. You know, one of the things that I actually did when I was there, so I noticed that they were growing and growing and growing, and they didn't have any assets or a replica process by which to train people. So what I saw was is that their most valuable resources, i.e. the most senior people in terms of letting agency experience, were spending their time training these newbies who had never done it before, because that seemed to be the kind of recruitment approach that the owner liked. And so off the back of that, you know, I had made so many different notes when I was learning, and anything that, you know, another lettings agent would tell me, I would write it down. And I actually created a training manual for them, and an asset to kind of guide those resources, as well as things that I'd come up with myself to leave the business with that so that they could actually grow. And that was something that was, really important to me actually before I left the business, that I gave them an asset to continue to grow it.
That's a very kind of advanced view for someone that was kind of just starting off and very kind of entrepreneurial in vision. Was that always at the back of your mind to be preparing yourself to start your own business?
It's a really interesting question. I think I always loved the idea. You know, it's a very glamorous idea. Like, oh, you own your own business.
Yeah. definitely is glamorous.
Yeah, it's not as glamorous as it sounds. But, you know, I think there was definitely an idea in the back of my head to do something. But I think before I could get here, I really had to nurture that self-belief, because otherwise I knew that I was going to be too, my identity was going to be attached to this business too much. So my value was going to be attached to it. I think I knew at some level that I wasn't mentally there yet. I knew vaguely, and I knew it was like an aspiration, but I knew that I had to do some things before. It was just like this deeper knowing, you know, not one that I was, that I had planned out, but I was like, not yet. I know that it's coming. And I actually, before I finished my master's, I was going to start another business with one of my colleagues from the master's. And I actually decided not to pursue it for that reason. I could tell I was a little bit too immature at that point. And from those places that I, you know, described in terms of that belief, that cultivating that self-awareness, right? Because you have to have self-awareness. You have to be able to, you know, reflect. And that wasn't fully developed yet.
That isn't, as you were talking there, the word self-awareness just kept coming into my mind there, because most people don't have that. Most people don't. We eventually get it, I think, but I think at a young age, which you probably were then, I think not a lot of people had that. So where does that come from?
Self-awareness.
How did you cultivate that self-awareness at a young age? Because usually at a young age, you're just full of this inherent confidence that, yes, I can do absolutely anything. And you have this naivety to just think, you know what? Yeah, I can do absolutely anything. So it's quite rare to see that in someone so young. So how did you do that?
I started journaling. I journaled quite a lot. And another piece that to add to my story was when I was 20. So I started my master's when I was 20. And with after the second month, I started to get really, really ill. And by Christmas, I was extremely ill. And I went into hospital on the 24th of December. I just always remember it as like Christmas Eve. I had to go to the doctors. And then on the 26th, my mom and I went back to the doctors. And he told me that I had an autoimmune disease. And that completely reframed how I thought about my body, how I thought about work, all these different things I had to look at in a way that I'd never looked at before. Before that, I was like, go, 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 go. I was, you know, I was all about fast speed. And what that taught me was, you know, I laugh at myself when I say these kind of things, but your health is your wealth, or your health is your wealth.
Yeah, say that voice. It definitely is better.
And that was actually what made me really turn towards yoga, made me turn towards understanding that, you know, I'm not a machine, I'm not a robot. So actually I need to understand the different emotions that are coming up in my body, because maybe they're contributing to this disease that I have. So, another piece that I'm aligned with is, Dr. Gabor Mate's work, who brought out a book that says, you know, when the body says no, and it's all linked to how our emotions can actually create diseases. So we can actually influence and shape our own diseases as well as our environment. Mm. But I think that was one of the most pivotal or defining moments in my life, was receiving that diagnosis, but then how I responded to the diagnosis. And again, just for honesty, I didn't respond to that, you know, straight away. You know, my initial response was, okay, I'm going to fight this. I'm going to da 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 da. But eventually I was like, okay, I have to accept this. And that, I think, naturally cultivated an introspective journey that I've been on ever since.
Mm. How long ago was that?
So I'm 27 now. So that was 7 years ago.
Okay. Wow. That was a young age to get such a serious diagnosis.
Yes. Yeah. It was a big shock. The doctor handed me a brochure for a colostomy bag and told me that the next step, so he put me on 12 tablets a day, and he said that this was the max dosage. And if this didn't work, he was going to put me on steroids. So I immediately Googled, you know, the symptoms or the side effects of steroids, and Googled all these different things. And I thank God for the internet, right? I found this story of a woman, a similar age to me and similar diagnosis, similar outlook from the doctors, and, you know, told that, you know, food wouldn't work. You know, it was all about the medicine. But with her story, she actually used food to treat the illness. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do the same thing. So I went to every kind of healer you can think of. I completely overhauled my diet. I said, okay, if the inputs that I had previously resulted in this, then I needed to change the input if I was going to change the output. So everything changed.
That's fascinating. Let's dig into this a little bit, if you don't mind, because that's such an interesting outlook and such an interesting journey to take. I think a lot of people just blindly just go, okay, doctor, yeah, no problem. Okay, fine. Yeah, oh, great. Oh, steroids, super. You know, they kind of, because generally it's kind of the easy route for a lot of people. So, mm-hmm. How did you decide to do that? Like, how you discovered this path, and then how did you make that decision to go, you know what, I'm going to overhaul everything?
I think two influences here. So I think firstly, my mom again. So being able to say, okay, actually I have more options. Actually, there isn't just one way to, you know, meet this challenge. And then the second piece is my granny. So my granny she's an absolute powerhouse, but I think you can't hold any profession or person, so even entrepreneurs or politicians or whatever it might be, you can't hold anyone on a pedestal, because at the end of the day, you know, we're all human. So you have to understand that what someone is giving you is one slice of the pie, and that slice of the pie is derived from their upbringing, their education. Mm. So it's just giving you one perspective. So actually, to see the whole pie, you've got to find other slices, other perspectives. And I think that, you know, that's what motivated me to say, oh, actually, you know, this is just what one person is saying. Mm. I'm like, what are other people saying? And I think I didn't really believe that food wasn't an influence, because without food, a human doesn't exist. Mm. So I knew that just this deeper knowing, again, not from any scientific research that I'd done, but that there is something more. I had to look into this a little bit more. And then when I did, I found, you know, a number of other people that were willing to say, yes, like, I can help. So that looked like, you know, Reiki, yoga, and food. I completely overhauled my food. I actually went on a, and it's not easy. It wasn't this you know, again, it's not a glamorous thing to overhaul your entire life. I tripled the time that I spent in the shopping for food because I had to really study the ingredient list. So it's, but I was dedicated to my body. I was dedicated to, you know, healing that relationship and creating this new vision, this new way of living. And I think actually one piece that made it a lot easier as well was that it was no longer a decision. This was my way of life. You know, people were like, oh my God, you know, that must have been really challenging. But yeah. Once I could see that, you know, because again, humans, so understand the way that we work in relationship with that. So humans get decision fatigue. And if you're constantly having to make a decision where you're like, yes, no, maybe, that's so tiring. Like your brain actually only has a finite amount that it can do every day. Yeah. So,
and you'll default into the lazy option. You'll default to what you've always done. What's the easy option?
Yeah. Especially when you're tired, angry, lonely, or hungry.
Yeah. And you're generally, we're all one of those at some point during the day as well. So it's always easier to reach for the snacks.
That sums up 2020.
That's like an hour. That's my hour in 2020. That's really interesting. I find the psychology part of that fascinating because as an entrepreneur as well, obviously your natural curiosity helped you. So what was the next step then towards being an entrepreneur? Because obviously you went on a massive journey there, a personal journey. So how did that bring you to where you are now?
So joining Deloitte was an amazing platform for me to learn all the different skills that I needed to launch a business. So I joined their technology, strategy and architecture part of the business. And I can't remember if I said this already, but you know, we had a 6-week training program where the focus was on learning. It wasn't about delivering. It wasn't about, you know, clients or KPIs. It was about learning and also networking. It was about, you know, they placed a huge emphasis on your relationships. I think in the first meeting that we had, you know, it was, you know, turn to the person on your right, and know that one of you is going to become the CEO of, you know, a Fortune 500 company or something like that. And
the Wolf of Wall Street thing there. Turn to the person on your right. They're not going to be here in 6 weeks.
It was a little bit more positive than that. It was a little bit more positive about that. But it was such an amazing experience. I was with them for 4.5 years. And the best piece of advice that someone gave me was during that training week was, you know, Deloitte is an amazing place to work for, but you have to create your own opportunities. No one's going to hand them to you. So in my first year, I just wanted to be a sponge. I just kind of wanted to absorb everything. And then in my second year, I decided I wanted to kind of, you know, hone in a little bit more about what I wanted my impact to be. What did I want that kind of, you know, legacy to be, I guess? What was I trying to manifest within my own self? So I decided that I wanted to go down the route of innovation. So I, alongside my client-facing duties, so where as a management consultant, just to give a definition, because actually before I got into management consultancy, I didn't really know what it was. you know, you hear all these different things, but it's, you know, you have different projects that come in from different clients across, you know, it might be public sector, financial sector, you know, the private sector. And you basically help those businesses to solve their most complex challenges. So challenges that are kind of difficult for someone internal to help solve because they're so close to the problem that sometimes it can be difficult to step back.
Yeah.
And so that's what management consultancy is. So that was my kind of day job. And I guess my side hustle within the business, or my extracurricular, was within innovation. So I went to, a director and a couple of partners in the business. And I pitched this idea of, and I was based in the Glasgow office, so up in Scotland. I pitched this idea of inviting Scotland's most disruptive startups to apply to pitch in front of us and our clients. And the recipient would actually be, or the winner would be the recipient of a 6-month sponsored secondment by Deloitte.
Oh, cool. And that's a very good idea.
Yeah. So the strategic part of that, because, you know, you always have to tie that back. It's like, okay, where is this creating, you know, value for the business? You know, you can't just do things for fun, as cool as that would be. Mm. And the strategic fit of that was, okay, you know, Deloitte is this huge corporation, but we're starting to see the startup revolution. And, you know, Deloitte is, you know, kind of this big steamboat ship that would like to, you know, move and respond to client needs, you know, in a really agile way. But actually, that strength is a strength of a startup. So for Deloitte, it's like, okay, how can we actually, you know, develop our relationship with the startup ecosystem, but in return, how can we help the startup ecosystem as well? So that was where the secondment piece, as well as tying the strengths of a base. So the last part of that is I successfully pitched that and we did an event and I actually got a DJ in. I think it was like the first time Deloitte ever had a DJ at an event. And it was just one of my pals from Glasgow. And we had over 100 people attend the event. I was so nervous that no one would turn up. And I ended up being nominated to be the secondee. So got to second into a startup while still being a part of Deloitte. Mm. So sorry, I think, yeah, that I started to build a brand for myself within Deloitte around innovation. And the startup that I joined, I think we were a team of 6 when I joined. And then by the time I left, it was around 12. But I worked really closely with the CEO of that startup. And after a month, he invited me to be the board secretary. He showed an unconditional belief in me. And, you know, he just said, run with the wind, Hannah. Like I started in the beginning, I was coming to him with ideas and, you know, pitching them to him. And he was like, actually, you know, this is a waste of both of our time. You know, if you have an idea and, you know, you've got the case behind it, he was like, just do it. You don't have to come to me anymore.
Great.
And that was the first time I had like this unbelievable. And, you know, in Deloitte, that's not possible, right? Because the bigger that you get, the more processes, the more approval and that you have to go through. But yeah, that really gave me that kind of, I could see the impact that I could have by, you know, not having anything around me, just someone saying, go.
Yeah. It's intoxicating as well. You get that freedom and you start to see if you're anyway entrepreneurial inclined and you start to see that, oh, I did this and then this happened. Oh, wow. I wonder what'll happen if I do this and this happens. Yeah. Like it's intoxicating. What did that company do?
So they were a fintech startup, within the credit space. So they were looking at the way a credit score is done. And it might sound boring, but it's actually really, it's so interesting. So they, Phil Grady is the CEO of that business. And they've since actually sold to Experian.
Oh, wow.
So they looked at the credit scoring methodology, which is based on historic debt. So in order for you to get a loan, so in order for you to get credit from an institution, they were looking at your debt and how much debt you were paying. And it wasn't real-time information. So actually what Castlight wanted to do was to look at real-time data, look at your current banking statements, look at the way that you're spending money now or in, you know, the last 12 months, and then look at indicators of someone who is a high credit risk and someone who's a low credit risk, but then also a better way of, you know, finding indicators for, okay, you know, if someone has never gambled before, and then in the last 3 months, you know, we can see, oh, wow, they're spending, you know, a lot more gambling than they have ever before in their lives. That's actually an indicator of potential for deferring on their credit. So a bank or any institution can actually step in and support that person before they start deferring on a loan or whatever it might be that they have. Mm. So it was looking at the market saying, actually, this isn't fit for purpose. Like this doesn't work. And then saying, here's another way that we can do it. And they actually use machine learning to do that. So analyzing, you know, hundreds of thousands of banking data, historical banking data to kind of get that view of what those indicators were.
And was that the first time where you're like, I think I can definitely do this myself.
Yes. I think having a CEO say, Hannah, you could be the next CEO of my business if you want. I was like, what?
Where do I sign?
Okay. yeah, it was one of the most rewarding experiences of my career. And I'm actually I still have a relationship with Phil. He's one of my mentors. And I think it showed me growth. It showed me how you can grow and also how you can be vulnerable as a leader as well. Phil was incredibly vulnerable with me, you know, showing me kind of the highs and lows of entrepreneurship and being incredibly honest about that as well. And, you know, we would, you know, maybe go off for a strategy session and he would bring that in as a part of it and ask me my thoughts and really gave importance to what I thought. And then I could see how that was influencing. I could see how I was making an impact. And I think that, yeah, that was kind of the start of me saying, oh, okay, yeah, as you say, like, I can do this. And actually, it's a human behind this business. I think sometimes if you've never worked in a startup, it's hard to kind of envision, oh, how does it work? Or what if I make a mistake? And yeah, like there are loads of mistakes made in startups. Like every startup could write a book of mistakes, but you know, it's how you respond to those mistakes and it's how you learn. And I think what I learned from Phil was it's how you use your network to decide what you're going to do next. You know, you don't have to do it alone. Like it's not a weakness to reach out to someone and say, hey, I'm really lost. Like I actually have no idea what to do. What do you think?
Yeah, it's super hard to learn that as well, because you don't know what you don't know. And you also don't want to show too much weakness because you don't want to spook people who are stakeholders or staff or investors. So it's hard to walk that line and be honest while still being, you know, not lost, not kind of flapping around going, oh, I don't know what to do. You know, it's a really hard skill. So it's very interesting you had such an influential mentor. So how did you go from there to LA Pacific?
So I started maybe after my secondment finished, I started listening to a number of different podcasts, first of all, in terms of in the entrepreneur space, actually. One of them was Alex Bloomberg, Gimlet Media. Highly recommend if you want to hear a founder story from start to finish, including him pitching to Chris Sacca, who was one of, you know, the early investors of Twitter. And Chris Sacca actually regurgitating his pitch to tell him how to pitch, all being recorded on a podcast.
Oh, wow. You're the second person to recommend that. I must go back and listen to that. It's Gimlet Media. Is it a series or is it a long ongoing podcast or what is it?
It's kind of Inception. So it's a startup. It's a podcast about a podcast startup. It's called, it's called Startup.
Wow. God, it's nearly eating itself. All right.
Yeah, but they actually sold to Spotify this year. I think I can't remember what the amount was, but it was incredible
to
follow.
It was a huge amount.
Yeah, and you get to go through the whole process with him, you know, re-pitching to Chris Sacca, finding his co-founder, building his team, nearly going under, you know, having resentment within the team, all these different things. It's fascinating. That was introduced to me by one of my colleagues, John, who I was working with in Deloitte. And it just opened my eyes up again to the founder journey. And then I also started listening to NPR with Guy Raz, How I Built This. So a wealth of kind of entrepreneur stories. And I think one of the things that I heard in that podcast was start noticing where you get irritated. So start noticing what annoys you, like in your everyday life, because if it's annoying you, it's probably annoying someone else too. That was kind of a bit of a process for me in terms of, okay, like what is annoying me? What's kind of a problem in my life? So yeah, I don't really describe it as kind of one aha moment, but it stems back to, you know, me getting ill a little bit as well. So I actually started whitening my teeth at 15 with whitening strips. And at 15, you know, as I kind of alluded to, all I cared about were results. Didn't care how I got them, where I got them. I just wanted results. So I remember seeing one of the girls who had been using whitening strips and she was getting all these compliments and her teeth looked so healthy. So I was like, I want these strips. You know, at the time they were actually illegal in the UK. I think I had to get someone's dad to bring them back from the US for me.
That's always a good sign that something is going to be really good if it's illegal.
Yeah, not a red flag to me. So yeah, I didn't look at the ingredients. I didn't look at the method. And ironically, the result that I ended up with was irreversible damage to my enamel. So the bottom part of my front two teeth They're actually semi-translucent, which is indicative of enamel loss, which was, you know, created by, you know, me not understanding the product, not understanding the harsh ingredients that were in these products. And also I was at that time, I was aligned with this mentality of no pain, no gain. Whereas it's like, after I got ill, you know, I was like, why would I invite pain into my life? So I started to ask the question, you know, why couldn't I have all the gain and no pain? So, you know, I still wanted white teeth at this point, but I was no longer willing to compromise on my oral health. So, you know, the pain and the extreme sensitivity, I remember I couldn't even laugh when I was using these strips. And because I just winced with pain, and I was just no longer willing to compromise that on anymore. And, you know, what I've learned since is that actually our oral health is connected to our overall health. So again, thinking about the body as one, not like these separate different parts, they're actually all interconnected. And something that I didn't know before starting LA Pacific was that, you know, for example, gum disease is linked to an increased risk of a serious cardiac event. So like stroke or heart attack. You know, Harvard Health have, you know, demonstrated links to Alzheimer's. You know, Mayo Clinic have links to, you know, early tooth loss, which has its own list of problems associated with it. So I started doing a lot of research, and I found that there was no product out there that kind of met my needs. So I eventually got through researching and figuring out, okay, there's actually nothing out there. I started talking to more people within my network about this problem, right? So the more that you talk, the more that other people say, oh, like, have you thought of this? Or, oh, you should talk to so-and-so, you know, kind of absolutely. Like we did at the start of this.
But it's highly underrated as well, because people have this thing, oh, I better not tell anyone my idea. They're going to steal it. They're going to steal my idea. Oh my God. I've known people who've done this. Oh, we're in alpha mode. What does that mean? We can't tell anyone. It's ridiculous. So like, it's great when people start off just by asking, because sometimes it's always like you're only ever one person away from getting the right answer. Someone's like, oh yeah, we did that. This is the answer. And you're like, oh my God, I've been doing that for 6 months.
Exactly. I'm totally aligned with that. You know, ideas, you know, people can contribute to your ideas. And that's what you have, you know, when you're in a team, it's like that creativity. It's like, sparks fly, through conversations. So I eventually, got introduced to my dental formulator, and we instantly clicked, you know, when we first met, it's so funny to me, we actually didn't even talk about kind of toothpaste or like a whitening product. What we spoke about were our values and what was important to us and, you know, what our visions were. And, you know, we both had, you know, lots of different ideas, and we were both really creative spirits. And I have a really good relationship with my formulator. And from that, LA Pacific was born. And with that, you know, we were able to create something that, you know, has never been done before. And that's really exciting to me. It's like, oh, actually, this is a world first. Like, no one's ever tried this before. And maybe they haven't, because actually it's challenging. It's challenging to do.
What was that, Hannah? What was your idea? What was your big vision? I want to do this. Can it be done? What was that?
It was, how can we create something that is safe? Because that was really important to me, right? Like, I've been through that with my body before. I'm not willing to compromise on that, but also effective. So how could I bring, you know, I was a customer first, and a beauty customer is, you know, someone who's results focused. You know, you're not just, you know, using a product because, you know, it feels nice. It's like, you know, you want to see the results that are promised as well. So it was about balancing something that was safe with something that was effective. And I guess the piece that my formulator is less connected to, but was interested in, was how was I going to do that? You know, how was I going to maintain the integrity of this? And I think that's what's maybe slightly different about LA Pacific and the way I want to do things is, you know, I want to make oral care cool. Like, how many people have actually looked or even know what ingredients go in their toothpaste?
Yeah.
And how can I make them want to know? How can I engage them in a different way? How can I, you know, educate but not lecture? And I said that I wanted to do that by, you know, merging two different worlds. I wanted to merge, you know, oral care with the beauty world, because, you know, I saw a revolution within skincare where, you know, and that's who I see as the leader of the beauty category. I saw how previously, you know, it was dominated by, you know, these big market players, and how, you know, over a number of different years, actually it's the small indie brands who, you know, are using their community as inspiration, or using culture as inspiration, or, you know, being really transparent about their science. Those were the companies that, you know, were coming up and starting to take some of that market share. So that was what I wanted to do with LA Pacific. That was the vision that I shared. And my formulator is the creative genius behind, you know, the science of it. But we work really closely together. And that was why actually our third product was also another world first. So that was really exciting as well.
Hannah, just tell people how old this company is, because from what you've said there, no one is going to be able to guess the answer to this.
That's true. So we launched with Boots in July 2019. Yes, July 2019.
So a year.
18 months.
18 months.
Am I getting that wrong?
No, you're right. No, like it's, I'm just saying that with humor, because all the stuff you've talked about there is the, if someone was saying that it was 10 years old, I don't think people would be overly shocked. So how have you, give us the secret, Hannah. Spill the beans here. How have you done this in such a short space of time? I'd imagine there was a lot of work went into the product previously.
Yes, definitely. So we, you know, there was lots of testing. You know, enzymes are incredibly difficult to work with because they're quite unstable. And we, again, bringing in kind of patience to it, but also bringing in expertise. So knowing, you know, I knew that I wanted to work with this formulator. I knew that, you know, he was the right person to work with. So, you know, if you, you know, build the wrong team, or, you know, you choose the wrong person, I think that can be a detriment to your business, you know, if you're just speed, speed, speed. So having the right people behind me to support me. And one of those people was actually a marketing consultant who I still work with today. And she actually has a wealth of beauty experience. So she taught me, I said I was a beauty customer, but that didn't mean I understand it. I could understand, you know, the back end of the retail business. Whereas, you know, she had worked with the body shop. So she had worked with Anita, who was, you know, this pioneering founder within what she did within the body shop. And then she moved on to L'Oreal. And then she also went on to work with Boots as well. So that was a really big helping factor. So just, again, tying back to who's in your network and who do you want to be in your network? Like, what skill sets are you missing that can really help you along your journey? And she was really, really instrumental in getting off the ground, as well as I also, you know, we spoke about this just briefly, but outsourcing the skills that I didn't have as well. So I actually went to my contract manufacturer and asked them to, you know, help me in, you know, a number of different areas as well. So in terms of the regulatory perspective, in terms of, you know, development. So all those kind of different pieces tied together helped it to get off the ground really quickly, and essentially create a product that not only resonated with the buyers, so i.e. the retail back end, but then creating a brand that would resonate with customers as well. So it's like those three things all tied together.
That's a little triangle. Massive undertaking. How long were you working on this before the product went on a shelf?
It was relatively quick. So I only met Declan in early 2019. After we met, I presented him with a brief and he came back in response with a brief. And then we were introduced by a mutual friend to Boots. And Boots actually, again, it's a timing thing as well. You know, they said, you know, we're actually looking for innovation within the category. Timing is a huge thing as well, I feel. And I don't know if you believe in, I don't necessarily believe in luck, but I believe in, you know, things being in flow, in a certain in a certain rhythm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you're putting the momentum, I'm a big thing. Momentum is my word. Everything is about momentum. I believe if you're building a momentum, luck and timing will combine, because suddenly if you hadn't been doing that, or if you hadn't been talking to that person, if you're just sitting at home going, I have a really good idea. You know, like no one, and I keep saying this to people, I was like, just start. People are always going, oh, I just want to start something.
That's so true.
No one's going to like, knock, knock, knock. Oh, hello, Hannah. We're really looking for innovation. You know, give us your best idea. It's luck is momentum and hard work. And there's loads of cliches about it. But I believe exactly what I like that word of flow. I definitely believe in that.
Yeah. And it's, when people think about toothpaste, you know, typically when you think about a brand, there's a lot of customer loyalty. However, you know, toothpaste is, it's a really interesting category because it's an essential product. Like we need toothpaste. You know, we want to keep our teeth, we want to keep smiling. But actually, it's a really overwhelming category to shop. You know, it's really difficult to differentiate between, okay, well, what does this do that this one doesn't do? And eventually, like, a customer actually gets completely overwhelmed and they end up just picking the cheapest one, or they end up picking, you know, the one that, you know, has the most text on the front. And, you know, I think most customers would resonate with the fact that most toothpaste, like when you look at the shelf, it's like this sea of white and red and maybe like a blue. And, you know, we're trying to bring in something that was different. So the marketing consultant that I had, you know, we worked really closely together in terms of our packaging. And again, we actually looked to skincare for inspiration from that. So, you know, when you think about a skincare product, they're really vibrant, they're exciting. And what you'll notice with our product is that you can actually touch the product. So not only can you see the product, but you can actually touch it before you buy it, which is part of a physical experience, which is part of, you know, the customer journey that, you know, we mapped so that they could get a feel, a sense for our brand. And with that, you know, and the way that we designed what copy goes on the packaging and everything, we were trying to simplify the category, which is music to a buyer's ears. Because if we're simplifying the way a consumer can shop, you know, we have the opportunity to, you know, really show that we can grow sales. We can not only excite your existing customers, but we can actually attract new customers. So that was actually where I brought in, you know, some of my consulting experience. And, you know, I love analytics and, you know, tying together seemingly disparate things to create a story. So one of the things that I do is actually a portfolio analysis. So I actually looked at the Boots portfolio and I said, you know, X percent of your portfolio cites this whitening agent. And the other majority is made up of this. And then you have a mix of X, Y, Z. And I said, this is where I fit in. And these are the reasons why. And, you know, looking at that from a pricing perspective, you know, looking at that from a clinical proof perspective. So skincare is, you know, there was a science revolution within that maybe around 5 years ago in terms of people clinically proving their formulas. Whereas within whitening toothpaste, only 20% on average from the different portfolios that I've analyzed actually have clinical proof behind them. So again, it's how can you excite the customer? What are you bringing that's different? And then how can you tell that story, which is, I guess, what we do on social, what we do on our website.
You have such a coherent message and brand and simplicity. I'm looking at your packaging here on your website, and it looks, it's very simple, as in, like, I can see exactly what all three products do. I can see, as you say, I can see the product, I can see it in front of me. It's not in a big wrapper. But like, where does this come from, Hannah? Because everything you've described there is a very sophisticated, very advanced comm strategy, marketing strategy, go-to-market strategy, manufacturing strategy. A lot of that is extremely, I'd imagine there's companies of hundreds of people with a strategy not quite as advanced as yours. So where does that come from? Is that your background, or is that just how you approach things?
No, I think I have to be totally honest. And I think that's something that every entrepreneur should maybe, or what I would suggest someone should do is, you know, look at where your strengths are. Look at where your network is, and then look at how you want to expand that. So with the marketing consultant, I knew that, you know, she's a powerhouse in terms of, she knows what she's talking about in terms of, you know, packaging and whatnot. And then I know that I'm a You know, you have to recognize your own strengths, which I think is something that we all need to do. But you also need to you need to document that as well. So I actually have and maybe something that I learned from Deloitte, where, you know, if you wanted to go for promotion, you had to say why, like what value are you bringing to the business. But it gave me a good template in terms of understanding, okay, these are where my strengths are, and then this is where I lack. So where my gaps were, I could say, okay, I need someone here, I need someone here, and I need someone here. So I was able to, once I had that view, I was able to say, okay, this person can help me with this. This person can give me advice on this. And this person can help me on this, which will enable me to focus on the places where I'm good at.
I'm going to go deep in the productivity nerd very quickly.
Tell me.
We're almost at the end. Talk to me about how you plan your week and your month, because that's a lot of work. That is a lot of work, and you're a busy person. So how do you squeeze the most out of your week?
For sure. So this was actually, again, advice that I received from someone else, but it was to look at, I guess I don't really look at it from a week to week basis. Maybe if I take back from them, I look at it from a month basis. So I look at, okay, what are my targets for the month in terms of, you know, the different areas, whether that be sales, community, whether that be new development. And then underneath each of those, say, targets that I have, then I have a number of different activities that need to happen in order to make those things happen. So then when I'm looking at my day to day, I'm looking at, okay, where am I actually spending my time in relation to those different targets? And what's going to take the most effort? Like, where do I see the most risk? And maybe this is where this has been like a learning for me, is learning about where the delays can kind of come in, and where the most effort is taken from me. So where, learning where there's a lot of a back and forth, and then feeding that into my plan. So then from a day-to-day basis, I have those different categories of my month view, and then what I'm doing within those. But within the day, I prioritize by, okay, what's going to take me the most effort versus what's kind of easy? What's something that like I really enjoy? So like, what do I want to finish my day on? You know, I'm not going to do my P&L budgets or, you know, my forecasting at 3:30, because I know I'll be here till, you know, 7:30, 8:30, 9:30. Like, I could stay here all night looking at numbers. So actually, I'm much better to, you know, focus on sales and numbers in the morning, and then do the creative in the afternoon, where I'm a little bit more relaxed. I'm, you know, can kind of flow those different things maybe into the new product development. Or, you know, if I know that I'm engaging with, you know, it has to be dynamic. So say with new product development, if I know I'm in a month where, okay, I have to get my testing into the lab, the product has to go in there, or, you know, I have to negotiate with my supplier on packaging, and I know that takes a lot out of my day, then maybe that'll be first. But yeah, I think I go from the month, which comes from the year view, and then I dial it back to just like a day by day, as opposed to a week by week.
What does your day look like?
Every day is so different. That's such a hard question.
I knew you were going
to
say that. There is no typical day, but what are the, I guess a better question from me is, what are your non-negotiables? What are the things you need to do? I guess on a personal level as well, like what, you know, we can't work all the time. So how do you seem like a very balanced person. You're clearly very in tune with your body and your mind. So how do you keep that, I suppose, on a weekly basis?
Yeah, for sure. And I think I have to be honest, like it's, that's dynamic too, right? Like sometimes it's out of balance, but I think the way that I perceive that is like, even if I'm wobbling, so even if things are potentially stepping out of balance, by wobbling, I know that I'm balancing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So one of the things is that daily practice that I mentioned. So journaling and actually putting pen to paper. Yeah. I find that very therapeutic, and it just sets me up. It means I can come from that place of reality, not this cognitive distortion, which might be grounded in fear and ego. And then moving my body, which does not happen every day, but it's something that I'm working towards. So yoga. In terms of business, connecting with my customer. So I actually run our Instagram page. So connecting with customers, which is like the pulse of the business, that's something that, you know, I do every day. And then because of, I guess, the stage that we're in as well, in terms of the growth phase of LA Pacific, is developing that business. So whether that's developing existing relationships that I have with suppliers or developing the business by going out and trying to, you know, gain new channels that we can bring LA Pacific to.
Super interesting. We're almost at the end of two last questions for you. One is going to be recommend a book that's had an impact on you. So you can have a little think about that for a minute. And the other one is just something that that struck me there as we were chatting. You know, you're so early in your journey, but you've crammed a huge amount in to the last, say, 2 years, 2.5 years. Is there one thing you know now that you wish you'd known 2 years ago?
I think it might sound really simple, but stock. Learning about how to plan stock, learning about how to, one of the questions that, you know, I would recommend to anyone going into this kind of business is understanding what the processes are to get your product like into a store, for example, and then understanding what the potential barriers of that are. So for example, with Amazon, you know, it's not just about sending your stock to the Amazon warehouse. It's okay, actually Amazon have a process, a particular appointment that your stock goes into. So you have to make sure that you hit that. You know, Amazon doesn't care if, you know, your lorry gets stuck in traffic or whatever that might be. and then Amazon's warehouse have their own schedule, and you know, that can take, you know, 3 to 4 days of processing. So and then what are the ramifications of that? So what's the impact to the business? So you can have risks, and then you have to ask, okay, what impact is that going to have to my business? And actually with Amazon, just with this example, it can be detrimental because Amazon's algorithm penalizes you if you're out of stock, because that means that you're upsetting the Amazon customer experience and what they want to afford to their customers. So okay. I think that was I wish I had gone out to find that expertise from, you know, planning stock, asking those questions, understanding the different processes to make sure I was prepared. So actually I never go out of stock, because even though it sounds like a really cool thing and it is exciting, but what that really means is that you're not selling.
Okay. That's a super answer. Thank you so much. That's something I've only started asking people recently, because I'm trying to dig down more into the practical side of things for people, because that's, I keep getting feedback off people going, that's what we really love hearing, is the practical bits that we can apply. That's why I ask people about their week, and it's why I ask people about lessons. Hannah, has there been a book that's made an impact on you, on your journey personally or professionally?
Yeah, so I feel like it's, you know, personal and professional are inherently tied to one another. So the book that has had a huge impact for me was Daring Greatly by Brené Brown, Dr. Brené Brown, which is based on 12 years of her research in terms of vulnerability and what it means to be vulnerable and how to be vulnerable and why that's important in business. So she brings in the science behind it as well. So whereas I was maybe skeptical before I was reading it, you know, she backs it up with both the kind of qualitative and the quantitative. And she does it in a way that I hadn't understood before.
That's brilliant. I'd actually never heard of that one, so I'll add that to the list. I think it's very important as well. It kind of ties into what you talked about earlier about being a kind of an open and an honest leader as well. Hannah, where can people, actually, can you just tell me what your three products are? Because I realized we didn't actually mention what they were.
Yes. So our first product is our 4-in-1 Action Enzyme Whitening Toothpaste. So this has four superpowers, as I like to call it. So the first one is our brightens. So this is all about our enzyme. And our products are different because the enzymes actually interact with the sugars on your teeth, and it transforms those into a naturally produced hydrogen peroxide, which creates our unique stain removal process. And also our results behind that are 82% stain removal in 2 minutes or whiter teeth in 60 seconds. We also have Pacific sea salt in there. So most people don't realize, but our teeth are actually like our skin. So in the same way your skin is porous, your teeth are actually porous as well, and they need a gentle exfoliation. So typically what you'll find on the market is that a lot of whitening products actually are polishers. So they have polishing ingredients in there. Mm-hmm. But what that means is, you know, sandpaper is a polisher, right? So okay. If you have a really harsh polisher, that's actually scratching off the surface of your enamel, which can create sensitivity. And yeah, for sure, it can create, you know, the appearance of whiter teeth, but at what cost? So we chose Pacific sea salt as a really gentle ingredient that we could use in the formula to, you know, help to lift and shift any stains. Then we also have optical brighteners in there. So a technology I hadn't actually come across before, but Californian opalescent crystals. So these leave a light blue film on the surface of your tooth, which then acts as a reflector or an amplifier. So when any light kind of hits your teeth, but it actually amplifies that illusion of white teeth. And then we also have Californian mint in there as well, which just leaves you with a really fresh breath. And then so the sister product of that, so the two products that we launched with, we have our extra sensitive version. So this speaks to all my sensitive sisters who maybe had a similar experience to me. You know, I know that sensitive teeth can be a barrier to whitening, or, you know, people can be scared to whiten their teeth because they don't want to have sensitive teeth. So this product has all the benefits of the 4-in-1, but then we've also got an extra ingredient in there, which actually alleviates any pain or discomfort. And then our third product, I'm really proud of this one. So we actually launched this in July 2020. And this is the world's first CBD complex teeth whitening toothpaste. So again, I kind of thought, okay, why does skincare get all the good stuff? Mm. And we've packed this with CBD, aloe vera, and vitamin E. So this is really kind of, you know, targeting gum health. But again, someone that wants to improve their gum health might still also want to whiten their teeth. And this toothpaste means that actually you can do both at the same time. And while you're brushing your teeth, something that you do every single day anyway.
You're giving me an overwhelming urge to go brush my teeth.
I love it.
Hannah, where can people buy it?
So we are available in all Boots Ireland stores. And we've also just launched with Boots UK, so both online and in store. We're also available at cloud10beauty.com, so an Irish beauty e-commerce website. We're available in Maher's and eBay and our own website, so lapacific.com.
Brilliant. Hannah, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
So yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
And that was episode 96. I hope you enjoyed it. Send me on your feedback as to what you'd like to hear for the 100th episode. We're coming up on it very fast. It goes out on New Year's Eve. So get in touch. Let me know, would you like it to be a founder episode? Would you like it to be an episode of me talking about 2021 planning and what the goals are and how I'm setting myself up for 2021 and success of how I'm going to pivot my business in 2021? Let me know. We'll do a special episode and it will go out on New Year's Eve. So let's do something a little bit special. I will see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab. Talk to you then.